May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be free from harm. May all beings love life. May all beings awaken. Welcome to another Qook audio podcast. This one is a memorial for Sandy Hollister. I'm DC Poobah of Qook Audio and Qook Archives, preserving the legacy of Shunryu Suzuki and those whose paths crossed his. I pray that you and yours are safe and comfortable and free from economic hardship and able to get out and do whatever it is you want within the limitations of the universal precept of do as little harm as possible. So before I talk about Sandy Hollister, we're going to have a pause to meditate. So if you're of a mind, hit pause and meditate or whatever for as long as you wish. And when you're ready to come back, hit unpause. And we will get right into our podcast with In Memory of Sandy Hollister. So what I posted was on May 7th, 2021, just learned that exactly a month ago, Sandy Hollister died of cancer. Sandy was a friend in the early Zen Center and a student of Shunryu Suzuki. Sandy began sitting at the San Francisco Zen Center at Sokoji in 1967 and later got involved with Gengo Akiba and Yoshi and the Oakland Zen Center. I think I knew Sandy before she started sitting there because she lived in the neighborhood. And I remember I was living with Loring Palmer, and this was 1966. And I know she didn't start sitting till the fall of 67, because you'll hear it when I read from her interview. But there was an astrologer named Gavin Arthur next door, or a few doors down where we lived on Buchanan in these lovely, wonderful old wooden apartments. They were so neat. Sandy went over and saw Gavin, and I'd known her. I already knew her just from the neighborhood. She was very upset with what he told her. He said it would be impossible for her to get enlightened. And, you know, Gavin he was very, very well-known astrologer. And he was, I went to a party at his place. That's where I first met Alan Watts. And I was new to San Francisco. And I go to a party next door, and there's Alan Watts and Jano, his wife, and Sufi Sam, and, you know, Gary Snyder went over there, various people. Gavin, what I experienced with Gavin on a more day-to-day basis was, you know, he was gay and he had a coterie or whatever you'd say of young men there that were looking up to him. I have this image of him speaking to him, about a half dozen guys sitting in front of him. I remember he was mad at one guy because of I don't know, maybe it was a lover's quarrel or something. And he called the cops on him, ratted on him, said he had marijuana, got the guy arrested. Anyway, so with that and with him telling Sandy she couldn't get enlightened because she had a chart, this and that, she was very upset. So I took her over next door to Zen Center to, what was his name? And he was a protege of Gavin's, but he was the opposite. Simon, oh God, I'll think of his name at some point. And he was the nicest guy. And he said, oh, well, I said, no, there's nobody that can't get in line. This just says you have some, you have these things to deal with here. And, but you will, you are capable of dealing with them, you know, more like that. What was his name? Maybe Simon. Anyway, he was a really nice guy. When my mother and sister came to San Francisco in 68, I took them over to get charts done by him and a meeting. It was really nice meeting. It was always pleasant being with him. Anyway, and then I saw Sandy at... you know, then she was at Tassajara later when I was at Tassajara, and she came and was a student there. And here I have a picture of her on her page on Cuke.com making a roxu. And that's Fran Keller in the background. There was an alumni reunion. An alumni retreat in April of 2012. God, that's just a year and a half before we came here to Bali. And I interviewed her then. I interviewed a few people. And I remember I drove her back to, that was at Tassajara. It was a Tassajara retreat for an alumni retreat. I don't know what the qualifications were, but the place was full of us, full with us. And I drove her back to Oakland or Berkeley to her apartment or her house. And what I had recorded with maybe was with her phone, because I didn't have a phone. Yeah, I did. All right, it was with my phone. And I didn't know what to do with, how to get it off or something like that. And so she took care of that, and she transcribed the at least her own interview. So I'm going to read from it now. And I had some exchanges with her later now and then. But... Not for a while. I was just thinking of her recently and thought about getting hold of her about doing a podcast. So, Sandy, here's your podcast. So she says, the first I heard about Suzuki Roshi was from Ruth Bosu, B-O-S-S-I-E-U-X. My friend and housemate in a flat on Bush Street about half a block from Sokoji. Around 1965, she had sat at Sokoji with the early groups of people, Dwight Brown, Betty and Shirley Wong, Phil Wilson, Gene Ross, Della Gertz, Bill Kwong. By the time I met her, she was no longer sitting there, but she told me what it was like for her and talked about the people she lived with in the houses across the street from Sokoji. That's an interesting comment, because we didn't have houses across the street from Sokoji for people that were apartments across the street for people that were practicing there till more like 68 started doing that. And Claude Dallenberg was in charge of that. So, you know, but it makes sense. Back in 65, there were people living across the street that sat there. So she says, Ruth was married to someone who knew Tim Buckley. Tim Buckley was at Tassajara. Tim came to our apartment to see Ruth's husband, Steve Tyler. Tim also talked to me about Suzuki Roshi, and he talked about how being at Tassajara had changed his life. He felt he had been on a downward track, and this experience he was having inspired him and made his life new again. Well, that's very true. I was roommates with Tim at Loring's and was very close with him. That's very true. So she says, that was very inspiring to me. Before he went back to Tassajara, he said, why don't you come and just see what it's like? So I did. I went in the fall of 67. I took a bus, and Tim was on a town trip, and he picked me up. We arrived at Tassajara at night after dinner. Someone gave us some food, and after we ate, I was washing the dishes in the little sink in the original kitchen, small kitchen, and Tim asked me if I wanted to sit with everyone. I said, sure, thinking this would take place the next day, and I could say no if I changed my mind. But he said, okay, let's go. Zazen is starting right now. I say, yeah, I was here then. She says, yeah, Suzuki Roshi wasn't here. I think it was in November near Thanksgiving. So he took me to the Zendo. When we walked in by kerosene lamp light, I saw rows of people sitting next to each other on cushions facing the wall, not talking or moving. It was amazing to me. I had no preparation for what I saw, had never seen anything like this. No one had ever described that part to me. I had never read about it. The concept was outside of anything in my life. Tim directed me to a zafu and sat down next to me and said, so here's what you do. Cross your legs. And he put his legs in full lotus, and you just sit here without moving until you hear the bell. Don't move. Then he got up and left. So I put my legs in full lotus. Wow, that's pretty good. I mean, I was in my 20s and was flexible, had been doing yoga, but I had never sat in full lotus for more than 5 minutes. But he said, put your legs like this. So I thought that was the way everyone was supposed to do this, and was already blown away by all the people sitting there without moving or talking. So the very first exposure I had to any concrete part of Zen Buddhism was this sitting, which I came to with no preparation, no prior knowledge or idea of what it was. My friend Ruth hadn't told me what actually took place in the Zendo. Much later, it seemed that this first sitting was a microcosm of the next 40 years of my life. I experienced a deeply review of every issue that I had to work with. Every button got pushed. Every fear was activated, especially when I saw this huge shadow slowly, silently moving over the top of the middle divider with the shadow of a long stick. Then randomly I heard the sharp slap of the stick hitting someone, and I literally started shaking in fear where I was sitting, thinking that when the stick came to me, I would be hit repeatedly until I, what, died, passed out? I don't know. But I didn't move. Then the person with the stick passed behind me and didn't hit me, not to mention the extreme pain of sitting in full lotus for 40 minutes without working up to that position. That night, I didn't sleep at all down in the last cabin across from the pool. No sleeping bag, no warm blanket. I couldn't get warm. So that was my introduction to life at Tassajara. But it inspired me, and I went back to San Francisco and sat at Sokoji for as long as it took to be regarded as a candidate for a practice period. Back in San Francisco at Sokoji is where I first met Suzuki Roshi. The thing about him was that I trusted him. I couldn't always trust the males in my life that had been father figures or role models, but he was someone in an authoritative position who I could trust. Everything he said to do, he also did himself, and that in itself was enough for me to want to continue with the practice, to consider him my teacher. So there I was with whatever my issues were in my 20s, and it turned out that one of my issues was that I felt that everyone else got it, and I didn't. And I didn't feel like I could personally relate one-to-one with him. I didn't want to because he had so much responsibility, all of us who were kind of crazy, and I didn't want to add to that. It seemed that I could get enough by just being at a distance from him. Of course, I also did put him on a pedestal. If he was here now, I know I'd have a different kind of relationship with him. But I loved him, his teaching, the way he lived, his gentleness. I remember the scent of incense on his robes when he walked past. The first time I had Dokusan was at Sokoji's during a session. Again, I knew nothing about what it was, what the form was, and I was so nervous that I didn't understand the instructions about what to do when I entered the room for Dokusan. So when I went into the room, I did everything wrong, but thought I was doing it right. First, I faced the wall instead of facing him. And we sat there for a long while, and then he said, "Turn around and face me." So with a deep feeling of shame for having misunderstood, I turned around and looked at him. He was sitting on a raised platform, and there was a light coming through the window. And when I looked at him, he looked so tired, and I just started crying for his tiredness, for his huge responsibility, or at least that was my projection on him. And that was my Dokusan, just crying. Sitting on a pedestal, that's interesting. That I've never seen him be on a different level from me or anyone in Dokusan. So that's what I did at that time. I worked my life so that I could be around him at Sokoji or Tassahara for the next few years. I had a job, but I would take off for 3 months so I could come here for a practice period, which I did twice. At that time, I liked observing the Japanese priests who assisted Suzuki Roshi, Katagiri Roshi, and Kobun Chino for clues about Zen and what we were doing. To me, the whole mystery of the practice and the foreignness of it seemed imbued with and intertwined with the culture of Japan. I somehow had this idea that if I could understand the culture that this particular kind of Buddhism came from, I could understand it better. It is in quotes there. I guess she means the goal of it all. DC comment. That was an est thing to say, "Have you gotten it yet?" or something like that. I mean, I've heard, I never did est. My interest and fascination of it did not come from reading about it or discussing it. In fact, the direction of my life at that time felt like it was out of control. So the grounding and focus that the practice gave me turned that around. I particularly liked the concrete rituals involved in the practice, zazen, chanting, bowing, oryoki, bells, hans, offering incense. So I asked, "Did you have any prior inclination or have you ever run into anything that interested you like meditation?" "No, my interests were mostly in music. I was drawn to music of India, flamenco, Arabic music, Appalachian music, Greek music. Also, palmistry, astrology, tarot, I Ching, and I practiced yoga with Shivananda in San Francisco until he moved to Canada. But Zen Buddhism was not something I knew anything about. But if you were talking about the pursuit of the spiritual, yes, that was always there in my life. What was that? What were you raised with? I was raised with nothing. My parents were Catholic, and they were excommunicated. They were excommunicated because they didn't get married in the church. And I say, no kidding? I thought that was really wild. Once I knew what that meant, because they were so harmless, it seemed so strange. And I say, wow, I never heard of that. So where'd you come from? Milwaukee. So my parents didn't say or do anything about any religion or any belief system. It was just a big blank. And I say, so when do you remember that you started thinking about it? Between around 6 and 11 years, I lived in a housing project during the war that was built for low-income families of servicemen. And I say, you mean World War II? She says, yeah. I said, well, when were you born? She says, 1942. Oh, really? Oh, I say, I'm surprised you look younger than that. And her birthday's May 4th. So she died. Oh, she died almost a month before her 89th birthday, I think. No, I mean 79th birthday. And I say here, oh, you've got 7 days till your birthday. She said, so there were a lot of kids living there, and I interacted with them every day. Well, almost all of them went to some church or the other with their families, and my parents didn't. So I attached myself to them and asked if I could go to church with this family or that family in turn. I wanted to know what that was all about. It was a mystery. So I tried a lot of churches because I was seeking something that was missing for me. And I say, at what age? You were trying out churches? Probably about 6 or 7. I didn't think of it that way. You would say, Mommy, can I go to church with so-and-so? And she said, yeah, something like that. The first one was a Baptist church. There was a hidden waist-high water container in back of the altar, and all I could see was the top part of someone walking. You could hear the water sloshing around, and then the minister would immerse the person backwards, and they would disappear and then reappear, dripping water. They wanted me to join the church, but when I asked if I would have to do that, they said yes. I gave them back the Bible they'd given me and said, sorry, I can't do that. So ever since, I remember there was something that I was seeking that wasn't available in everyday life, something spiritual. Huh. Oh, and then now here I tell her about her being upset by Gavin and going to see Simeon Nash. And she said, so anyway, I bring that all up. And she says, yes, I still remember some of the things Gavin Arthur said that were so scary and ominous. She says, he really didn't like women. I'm cutting out my comments here. I said, well, let's go back to the way-seeking mind. Did you do anything in high school around that? She said, not really. I just always had the feeling that there was something more, something beyond every day, but not going to church. Went to San Francisco, stayed a while. But I was trying to major in music without a music background. It didn't work out. She says, I came to California in 62 with a woman I met in Milwaukee who was coming to UC Berkeley to get her master's degree in art. And after we came here, she met Jenny Baker, and Jenny was coming to Tassajara to do the inventory after Zen Center bought it. That's how I first came to Tassajara. I went with her and Jenny to Tassajara to do the kitchen inventory. I remember that, IDC, remember that. I say, yeah, I worked with Jenny because I'm the one who bought things for the dining room. Jenny selected the plates and the silverware and this and that. But I'd go out and buy it. She was sort of the interior decorator, and I was the one doing the work. I was the one who made the first napkin rings and went out and selected bamboo. And so she says, Oh, she says, this woman, Renee, who knew Ginny, Renee Luby. And I said, oh, I know Renee Luby. Wow. And I'd say, no, I'd say she ran the Montessori school. She and Yvonne and Ginny started this Montessori school. And my sister ended, she became the secretary. And then Renee started teaching more, and Susan ended up running the school. Just scanning over some stuff in the interview here. Oh, so she ended up as a cook there. Oh, and she said she met me because my sister worked there. Oh, wow. She didn't really have, Sandy didn't really have much of a relationship with Zen Center after Suzuki died. She said, I moved to Berkeley around 70, 71. In 72, I had a child, was a single parent. My active involvement ended with the Zen Center around then. So I said, well, what happened to the child? He's 40 years old now. So that was 12. That was 9 years ago. He spent the last 7 years in Southeast Asia traveling, following Buddha. He wanted to see the birthplace, the Bodhi tree, all of the places connected to Buddha. After that, he settled in Thailand, got married, and has two children. He's here now and working on bringing his wife and kids here soon. Huh. So there was a practice period. The first one with Tatsugami in the spring of, she says, 69. No, it was 70. Was just starting, and I wanted to go to it, but I was told to interview with Suzuki Roshi since it was too late to register. So I met with him, and he was very gracious and served tea and gave me a small wooden bench to sit on. I told him why I was consulting with him and said that I wanted to go to Tassara to have something hard to throw myself into because of missing Amber. He said, if you want to do something difficult, the hardest thing would be to stay right where you are. He was right, of course, but he approved my application anyway. I was allowed to go to Tassara again. That was my second practice period. And I asked her, well, do you have any involvement now with any practice or group? And she says, well, I sat at the Berkeley Zen Center for a while. In the early 80s, I heard from a client of mine about Ekai Korematsu, who was the priest at a small family zendo in Oakland in the attic of the home of Yoshi and Kaz, the owners of Yoshi's restaurant. So I started sitting there and served as treasurer there for over 30 years until about 2 years ago. Around 1987, Gengo Akiba became the resident priest. A couple of years later, they moved a few blocks away, and they were married, Yoshi and Gengo Akiba married, and eventually built a small Japanese temple on the property in Oakland. Yeah, it's beautiful. I still practice there. That's very interesting, I say. I've never interviewed anyone who said anything about Yoshi's zendo. I've sat there and visited Yoshi and Gengo a few times. It always seemed like a private zendo to me. They didn't really, at that time, seem to want people to know about it. I don't know. So, she says, I had a dream early in the morning about the time that Suzuki Roshi was dying. I was living for a short time in Oregon and didn't know that Roshi was dying. In the dream, Suzuki Roshi was at Sokoji downstairs in the part of the temple reserved for the Japanese congregation. He was zooming down one of the aisles toward the altar, and his feet weren't touching the ground. As he went, he kept taking different hats on and off his head, and when he got to the altar, he fell down onto it, and his head cracked open, and he started bleeding. After that, I was in a room that looked like a room at Sokoji where they have doksan during a sesshin. I was standing below a raised platform where Mrs. Suzuki and Suzuki Roshi were sitting side by side. Oksan shook her finger at me and said, now you have to take care of him. Later, when I found out he died at that same time, it didn't surprise me because he had such a profound effect on so many lives. So thank you very much, Sandy Hollister, for having that interview with me. And gyate, gyate, hara gyate, hara sam gyate, bodhisvaha. This has been a Kyuk Audio podcast. I'm D.C. Puba of Kyuk Audio and Kyuk Archives, coming to you from Sleepy Sanur with Doggett Bandita, Feline Kuchita, and dear lovely Katrinka. And we're wishing you and yours and all of us a grand awakening.